Time to take a look at climate and weather now. But before we get to that, and something I should have said at the beginning of the show, we had a wonderful time yesterday. We had our Cajun cookout at our home, Renee and I, and Joy Cardine and Jean Faraca and myself and Cheryl Gasser were joined by, oh my goodness, about 40 other people, Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, and we had kind of the best possible time that you could have. And I really enjoyed it. And a big thanks to Tim Hall, our Cajun cook, who put on a wonderful Cajun dinner for us. And it was, and the best part was it rained a little bit about a half hour before the event. And then it was nice, except for the wind.
Yeah, it was chilly. It was like a tailgate party, probably, right? I mean, it felt like late October.
Yeah, we were, and we ate outside and everything. Mm-hmm. But the one good thing about the wind, no mosquitoes.
Absolutely. Oh,
yeah, I don't think anybody got a mosquito bite, and I don't think anybody had to put on any repellent or anything.
Yeah, it was the same at the fireworks on Saturday for us. The wind kept them away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to help Ann at her community garden plot, which is kind of sheltered, and so there was no wind.
Oh, yeah.
I got eaten alive.
Yeah. Those suckers, they can't take a 5-mile-an-hour wind.
No, they can't. They just don't have that wing strength, I guess.
Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, one of our weather guys. The other, John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. If you have a question relating to climate or weather for them, and we don't care what it is, just try and stump them. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call, and we can certainly talk about water.
Oh, boy.
Man, I tell you, and some communities in southern Wisconsin got an entire summer's rainfall in like 4 days.
Yeah, that was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I know the Wisconsin Dells got 12 inches there between the 5th and 8th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that week period was just amazing in terms of the amount of precipitation that came down.
So much water that Lake Delton doesn't exist anymore. So
yeah, and you know, which is amazing. And the filming of the film that you see where that just rushing out is phenomenal.
Yeah, it is. And I think 600 million gallons of water emptied effectively into the Mississippi. Some of those levees in Missouri and maybe further downstream next week, they have to have been impacted negatively by that 600 million gallons of water. That doesn't just disappear.
Yeah. I mean, you could, I think it's the USGS site has a site where you can go to the rivers and look at the discharge in the river at the various river gauges. And if you go to the Wisconsin River, you can see when Lake Delton empties.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's just this big spike. They just boom, and it doesn't last very long.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a big rush of water that's just coming down the whole river valley. It spikes and then it just ends.
Well, what is it about what conditions have to come together to create something like 12 inches of rain in a matter of a day or two?
That's a really good question. And this is true broadly for all flash flood events. And this was more than a flash flood event. This was a broad, long-term flood event. But even for flash flood events, thunderstorms in the summertime are capable of dropping precipitation at a rate of an inch an hour or more. And in some cases, that's really an extreme amount of water to be falling out of a cloud in 1 hour. 1 inch of liquid equivalent, it's hard to believe. But when those things are stationary over a location, and so you get several hours of that sort of rate, that's when you really get hammered with these kinds of rains. So on this particular event in June, we had a weird combination of very, very strong, almost wintertime strength upper-level dynamics fueling some of the production of the clouds and precipitation, and all of it tied to a rather stationary boundary at the surface or in the lower troposphere. And so the same things kept happening over the same locations, fueled by very, very strong dynamics, the kind you don't usually get here in the summertime. And that combination, rare though it is, does happen occasionally, can really lead to, you know, 1 foot of rain in 4 days because you have persistent moderate to heavy rain over a period of time.
Now, would climate change be, would there be anything that we could say, well, climate change might lead to more of these kinds of events or less or fewer?
I don't know how those connections can be made very strongly right now. I think we're trying to understand how some of those global scale changes in the atmosphere's behavior are going to telescope down to the regional scale. But in the particular event we're talking about, there were so many small-scale local effects that contributed to that disaster that it's really hard for me to imagine how we'd be able to say with great confidence that, yes, this is a global climate change issue that focused right down on the southern counties of Wisconsin. I find that hard, the connection hard to make right now.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. Models are predicting that we'll have more moist conditions and more thunderstorm-type activities. But I think to start attributing a single year's event, well, you can't. You need multiple years. Mm. And as much as we've had, you know, we're still not at the record. There's been years in the past where we've had more precipitation in that 356 time period.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it's not – it's really odd, and it's out there on the extreme. But yeah.
But it's there, and it could be even worse.
It could be worse. Right.
Joe in Milton has a question for you. Joe, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Maybe it kind of goes along with what you guys have just been talking about, but I work in agriculture, and over the last 20 or 30 years, it seems like more and more weather systems just seem to get stuck in a holding pattern. Once it starts raining, it keeps raining, and once it stops raining, it stops. Do you guys seem to be finding that too? And
yeah, what about that?
I don't have enough experience on summertime rain events. It's not exactly my bag, but... I've not heard anybody who does have that expertise make that statement. So I think there are plenty of counterexamples in the last 10 or 20 years where you could say, like 1988, 20 years ago this summer, it was dry as a bone, and it was hot. And so nothing was happening precipitation-wise. And then only 5 years later, 1993 comes along, and it rains very much the way that it did in early June, but that was delayed till July and August, and it lasted longer. There were a couple of weeks of that instead of 1 week. And maybe more than that. So it's hard to know, not being an expert in that exact area, to be able to say. But I haven't heard anything from colleagues who are particularly attuned to that area.
It seems like this year we're in a wetter pattern where we've been getting excessive rain since December. I mean, excessive moisture.
Yeah.
I mean, we had
a
lot of snow and a lot of rain. And I guess in agriculture, I think we're seeming to be noticing that more and more.
Yeah. This year particularly, I'm sure you felt it right from the very get-go of the spring. It was already way too wet. And then with all this rain, you know, there's a real washout in some ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it started back in August of 2007.
Yeah, right.
And we had some real record precipitation back then.
But we don't, you know, it's easy to forget. We had that crazy winter where we had over 100 inches of snow here in Madison. But remember
easy
when we
to
were,
forget.
Well, in this sense, remember early February when we were stumbling over the 90-inch accumulation mark. At that time, Minneapolis had only had 25 inches of accumulated snow. So it wasn't as if the entire region had this wild snow. We had a bullseye on our back from December 1st to mid-February.
And frankly, it's usually the other way around between Minneapolis
absolutely
and us.
Right. That's right. Absolutely
they're the ones
right.
with the 90 inches.
Right. So it was a narrow strip over the southern counties of Wisconsin that really got hammered up through mid-February, and then it evened out a little bit more after that.
Yeah. Well, and northern Wisconsin was dry.
Right. That was not a good snow year for a lot of places up there. So.
Well, they've had an ongoing drought.
Yeah,
that's right.
Wisconsin. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Joe, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We didn't get quite answer all of your question, but we got a good share of it. Roger in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Raj.
Hi. Well, you've kind of answered the question I was going to ask, so let me ask another. Are there any things that we can predict in the way of changes to our weather patterns around here, Wisconsin or southern Wisconsin, as a result of global climate change, besides warming?
The information that I've seen deals with more precipitation and heavier type precipitation. But again, you know, there's a lot of big error bars and uncertainties on this. And then in the wintertime, obviously, if we're going to be warming up, looking at less snowfall.
Less snowfall, did you say?
Yeah, right. But you can still get that precipitation in terms of rain.
Less precipitation than last year or than the average over...
Yeah,
20 or 30 years.
That's a good point. When I'm talking climate, I should really talk about the time interval. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm not talking about next year. I'm talking about next, you know, 25, 30 years from now. I think I wouldn't project what's going to happen next year. In fact, you know, looking back, the projection for a snowfall in the 2007-2008 winter was equal chances of normal, above normal, or below normal. And, you know, I mean, it was a record year. So,
but not everywhere. Not everywhere within a 100-mile radius.
Good point.
So you know, this is one of the really good questions in our science right now. I think it's where the next revolution is going to be made. People take for granted the fact that the 1 to 2 day forecast, and I'll say even in the month of June and July when it's really difficult to forecast the weather because systems that affect the weather every day have 1 or 2 hour lifetimes, they're just about right on the nose now 90% or more of the time. And people take that for granted. What we're hoping we can do next is figure out how do these global climate changes affect regional weather over the period of the next season or a couple of seasons coming downstream. We're not there yet. And so it's very hard to answer those questions, but that's exactly where we're trying to go right now, because that's where the next revolution in forecastability is going to come. It's right
there. The next couple of years, heavier precipitation, as was recently, but over the long term, drier.
I think Steve said less snow, which I'd agree with. Yeah. As it warms up, we'd have less wintertime precipitation in the form of snow, but there may be more overall precipitation in the wintertime. More of it being rain, right?
Long term.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Roger, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mike in Millidor, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, gentlemen, I'm out baling hay right now, thanks to the nice weather we're having up here.
Good day
but
to do
my
it.
Question relates quite well to what that last gentleman just asked, in which you made a comment about the 1 to 2 day forecast being pretty much right on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But my problem is I need the 3 to 5 day forecast.
Right on. I know.
And I've enjoyed the internet. I'm a weather junkie because I need to know. But I've been looking at following jet stream patterns and trying to predict what the 5 day is going to be, and then I found the quantitative precipitation forecast from NOAA has been pretty accurate. What I'm wondering is, where do I look? What are the good clues that can at least give me a fair chance of getting this right?
At 3 to 5 days.
Right.
Yeah, I for me, in the summertime, the thing that I'd be paying some attention to is any kind of weather map that tells me something about frontal positions. So that'd be a surface map that you can probably find on any of these websites. But then I'd also want to pay attention to what's the temperature at about a mile above the ground, the so-called 850 millibar level. Most of the weather sites that you look at with forecast maps will have that map on them. And if you see a fairly rapid drop in that temperature, I'd say in the summertime, anything cooler than about 5 degrees above 0 Celsius, if that kind of air invades, you got a pretty good chance of some showery activity. And I don't know how much showery activity on a given day. That'll depend on the frontal positions to some extent. But that's the kind of situation in which you start to wonder if there's going to be a little bit of rain. But most of the forecast models themselves, with the surface panel forecast, they're going to tell you, we think there's a chance of some accumulated precipitation there. So even that 3 to 5 days out, you can get a pretty good guess.
Yeah. Well, this last batch of storms that came through, I've never been as lucky as I've been this time. And we were out cutting or raking hay, and there was storms to the north and south, but nothing hit us. And
that's perfect.
Wow, lucky.
Perfect. for once at work, Mike.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve Ackerman and John Martin are weather guys here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at climate and weather now with our two weather guys, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, who come by the last Monday of every month to talk climate and weather with us. You may have a question. I hope you do. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And we have callers online, so let's go right to the phones here and to Margot in La Crosse. Margot, hello.
Hi, Larry and Weather Guys. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Good. Great.
Good.
I have a question. I don't know if it's weather related or not.
Everything is weather related.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Well, that answers.
Why am
that.
I not getting paid enough? No. My question is, how come on some clear mornings you can see like a white outline or a white image of the moon when the sun is coming up?
That's
a white.
Well, it looks like you can usually it's crescent shaped or it's about a half moon. You'll see it in usually the west sky.
Oh, yeah, because the moon sets there. Yeah.
Yeah. So when the sun is coming up, it's not actually like glowing, but it almost looks like it's reflecting off of something.
So you're seeing a whole disk of the moon or a ring around?
No, usually a crescent or a half moon, but not like a ring.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. It's interesting because you can tell the sky's getting brighter and the sun's coming up, and you can still see the moon in the western sky. I delivered papers as a boy in the morning, and I used to see that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just that what you're seeing is that all the moonlight that you ever see is reflected solar radiation off the surface of the moon, bounced back to Earth, and you just haven't gotten the sky bright enough to eliminate any ability to see the moon, because you've got, you know, a brightening eastern horizon and a still dark western horizon, and that's where the moon sits. So there was a period of time in the morning on those days, and I think I remember, too, that it was mostly a half moon or a crescent,
yeah,
and
I
you
see
can see them
often.
At the same time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that the western sky hasn't been lit well enough to hide that very, very faint, what is it, 1/60th as much radiation?
So is it still?
I mean, in terms of brightness or something
right,
like
yeah.
that, or it's even smaller than that. So as soon as the sun really gets you know, above the horizon in the east, you're going to just, you can't see that moon anymore.
So is the moon actually there then, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's setting in the west, yep.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that's cool. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Margo. Martin in Wautoma is up next. Hi, Martin.
Hello. I grew up south of Chicago, and in the summertime, we had a lot of what was called heat lightning or dry lightning. Mm-hmm. Where you could see it in the sky behind the clouds, but it wasn't associated with any storms or rain or anything. Now, is that something like what happened in California this past week? And is that what is the relationship between that kind of lightning and what happens in real thunderstorms?
Yeah, actually, when you see heat lightning, you're still getting the thunder associated with it, and it's still part of a thunderstorm. It's just that you don't hear the thunder. The sound wave never makes it to you. So that's one. So it's still part of a regular lightning storm. The fires that are starting in California by lightning are basically the same thing. They're lightning bolts that are coming out of storms, although sometimes you'll get lightning coming out of the sides of storms, so it's not raining in that area. And it's those lightning bolts that can really help to cause forest fires if the ground is really dry.
Yeah, it's very common in the western United States for the lowest part of the atmosphere to be so dry that even if rain is falling out of that thundercloud, it's not going to hit the ground as liquid water, it evaporates.
Oh,
but you can still get lightning out of it.
Yeah. But lightning is lightning generally in the troposphere.
So
there are different types, actually.
Heat lightning is really lightning.
Yeah, heat lightning is just lightning that you don't hear the sounds because the sound wave either can get absorbed before it reaches you, but more commonly, the sound waves just bend and they just propagate upward away from the surface.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. And part of it was living south of Chicago where there weren't many trees, and so you saw lightning from far, far off compared to up here where your trees limit your sight line.
Yeah, when you're in flat ground like in Illinois or in the prairies of Colorado, you get to see heat lightning a lot more than living in the city.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marty. Appreciate the call. Milton in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Milton.
Okie doke. Hi. Hi to all of you.
Hi.
My question has to do with the frustration that I have sometimes when I hear weather forecasts for the entire state. Mm. And the location of weather events seems to me to be real imprecise. I'm wondering why we don't have some sort of a zonal designation like we have for planning so we could express more precisely where these weather activities are going to occur.
Yeah, if you go to the National Weather Service, they'll do that by zones.
Mm-hmm. They do it by zones.
Yeah, they do it by zones. But, you know, when people are going to give just a brief description and they only have a short amount of time, they generally overgeneralize. Even our favorite national public radio stations tend to do that, too.
That is one group I was thinking of.
Yeah, it's going to be in the 70s today, and it's just like, what do you mean in the 70s in Wisconsin?
Yeah, the only state that's immune to that is Rhode Island.
Right. Maybe Delaware.
Forecast in Providence or in somewhere in Delaware is probably okay. But, yeah, that's right. The Weather Service will give you a zone forecast. That's a little more specific.
The state broken up into zones or just the country?
No, the state.
Oh, okay.
The Milwaukee forecast office has jurisdiction over about a third of the state, and they divide that third of the state into zones. And so you do get a little bit more specificity.
I see.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Milt. Joe in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Joe.
It is real hard to predict the weather. Nature tricks us all.
That's a fact.
The question I had for you is I watch a lot of television shows on the History Channel, Discovery Channel. They have these computer modules that show that Wisconsin will be more colder and drier, and they also predict that the sun will put off less heat, and that'll dictate the result of global warming as well. Have you guys heard anything on those levels at all?
Yeah, actually, the solar output is on a local minimum now. And so it has a minimum in terms of the amount of solar energy that it's outputting. And yet, you know, 2007 was still one of the top temperature records. So even if the sun is output is going down, we're still predicting and looking at global warming.
Yeah. And the people who are talking about cooling aren't making predictions. It's very interesting. That's something that I note all the time. They say, well, how do you know it's not an ice age that's coming? Well, where is the people who are making forecasts about that? They're nowhere.
They disappeared, didn't they?
They did.
And so when the solar output does change, we're not talking about a, you know, 20% change in the amount of energy the sun puts out. We're only talking about a small fraction in percentages of how much energy is coming out.
I suppose it depends on the Earth's atmosphere as far as us depleting the ozone layer and stuff like that, allowing sun in.
It's not so much depleting the ozone layer as it would be in terms of like producing pollutants. Would we flex solar energy back out to space, or putting in carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which don't affect the amount of solar energy reaching the surface, but actually affect how much heat the atmosphere absorbs that the Earth's surface is trying to emit and get out to space in order to cool down.
Gotcha. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Roger in Black River Falls, we're on to you now. Hi, Roger.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good afternoon. My question has to do with the water temperatures on weather patterns.
Effect of Great Lakes water temperature on weather patterns?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I sail considerably on Lake Michigan in the summer, and this year, as a for instance, we're about 10 degrees colder for the time of year on our surface water temps than normal. Mm-hmm. And I was curious if this is a factor that you look at in how the models and how the predictions move across Wisconsin.
My initial sense would be that on the very local scale, let's say sort of sea breeze or lake breeze cumulus clouds that might develop in an afternoon, they will be substantially impacted by a 10 degree colder than normal. And I'm assuming that's 10 degrees Fahrenheit, so we'd adjust it to about 5 degrees Celsius, but it's still very substantial departure from normal. And that's going to take a little bit of the oomph out of thunderstorms that might otherwise develop along the lake breeze front, for instance. It won't probably change the large scale, that is 10 to 12 to 15 state scale sort of weather systems that come across, but it will modulate them when they come across the Great Lakes. One of our colleagues used to be at the University of Michigan did a long-term study on the effect of the Great Lakes in the wintertime on pressure in the whole region, sea level pressure in the whole region, and there's a discernible impact. The pressure is about 0.2% lower, and that's substantial for the atmosphere in the vicinity of the Great Lakes during the wintertime as a consequence of the fact the water is much warmer than the air. And so if it's much cooler than the air in the summertime, that's going to have the opposite effect, probably decrease the amount of sensible weather that comes out of the lakes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Appreciate that call. Ben in Heartland, it's up to you now. Hi, Ben.
Hi there, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, my question is more broad, but I had the question about the jet stream and the ocean currents, and I was wondering why they're there. Do they have anything in common? Do they work together? Do they work against each other? What's going on with that, and how does it affect our weather? Because I know that, like, I just noticed that from the storms coming from, always coming from the west in Wisconsin, coming down towards Milwaukee, and I was getting up.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll talk about the jet. You want to talk about the ocean?
Yeah, that'd be good.
All right. The jet stream is our great Reed Bryson just died a couple of weeks ago, who was one of the people who discovered the jet stream while serving in World War II in the Pacific, esteemed professor here. The jet stream is a river of winds at about 6 miles or so above the ground, and that is a result of the pole-to-equator temperature contrast. It's much colder at the pole than it is at the equator all times of year. That temperature contrast is exacerbated in the wintertime, of course. And as a consequence of that factor, as well as the Earth spinning on its axis, in both hemispheres, the winds generally go from west to east in the middle latitudes, which accounts for why the weather systems tend to move from west to east, whether you're in the northern or southern hemisphere. And the jet stream is the level at which the winds reach their maximum speed. And as a consequence of that temperature contrast, the winds will increase with height from the west as you go up until you get to that level where the temperature contrast changes, actually, in the lower stratosphere. And those are locally very, very strong winds, sometimes as fast as 160, 180 miles per hour. In summertime, more likely about 70 or 90 miles per hour. And that's the atmosphere part of that story. Steve's got the ocean part.
Yeah, and I guess the ocean part, you can think of it in a very similar way, in the sense that you have these imbalances, as John was talking about, with regard to the amount of energy we get in the polar regions versus the tropical regions. And so the atmospheres and the oceans are working to transfer energy out of the tropical regions to the polar regions. And they do this very effectively in the atmosphere with the jet streams and storm development. In the oceans, we kind of have a similar thing. Almost, you can almost think of them as jet streams in the oceans. I'm thinking particularly like the Gulf Stream. Those are warm currents that are taking water from the tropical, subtropical regions and moving them poleward. And in fact, you can almost think of it as a stream, kind of Gulf Stream, jet stream, kind of related. The difference between the, or a difference between the ocean jets, if you will, and the atmospheric ones is that there are boundaries in the oceans called land. And so a lot of times you'll find these warm streams of water on the east side of continents, and then on the west side of the continents you'll find the cold water.
Yeah, like the California Current.
Right.
And they move a lot slower.
They move a lot slower, right.
Yeah. Even Benjamin Franklin noticed that. That's like 1 or 2 meters per second in a really fast ocean current or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And we're talking 50 to 60 times faster for the atmosphere. So, and the disturbances that develop along these currents move a lot faster and live a shorter lifetimes in the atmosphere as well.
And then, of course, there's interactions between the ocean currents and maybe not so much the jet stream. Well, I guess they interact through weather systems.
Yeah, through weather systems. Yeah. That's the conduit through which they interact. Yeah. So there is some interaction, but they pretty much don't know each other. They're like sixth cousins, I guess. Maybe occasionally there's an episode where they kind of know they're there, but it's not that common.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, man, for calling. Kevin in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kev.
Hi. Thanks for the call. I've noticed that the last few years that when there's storms coming in, the weather guys on the TV will just go on hour after hour of coverage, which is great. But what I've been wondering about, they seem to call the circular motion in the storms tornadoes. And I didn't even know if those were confirmed funnel clouds or what do they actually constitute a tornado warning when there is one touchdown on the ground? Or a funnel cloud, or this circular motion?
You'll get a tornado warning if a tornado is spotted, or if they see a funnel cloud, or even a wall, rotating wall cloud.
And I think even now the signature on the Doppler will probably prompt a warning.
Yeah,
and that is an observation that would have to still be reported by someone on the ground. Did the presumed rotation that they see in the Doppler radar actually show up as rotation in the clouds or as a funnel cloud? That's something that would still have to be verified, but that would still prompt a warning, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because they show all this circular stuff, and it's almost like overkill, because it seems like there would be a lot of that up there, and some of them are calling those tornadoes. Where I wouldn't think they are actually a confirmed tornado yet.
Yeah, they're not confirmed. They often call them Doppler-indicated tornadoes. And then they're waiting for confirmation from someone on the ground to actually put it in the books as a tornado.
Hmm. And, you know, the National Weather Service, by some estimates, have already said there were nearly 1,200 tornadoes this year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our 10-year average for the whole year.
Right.
We only had a half the year to go yet.
Yeah. It's way ahead of schedule.
So, yeah, I was thinking the same thing, that, you know, it seems like we've had a lot of warnings this year, and, well, a lot have occurred, actually.
Yeah, that's right. And, in fact, I should point out that those 1,200 are, in fact, verified by observations on the ground. Those are not 1,200 Doppler-indicated tornadoes, and who knows how many of them actually turned out to be real tornadoes. Those are all real tornadoes.
Yeah. And you've got winds up to 200 miles an hour.
Yeah, easily around these things. Yeah, these an F3 or an F4 can easily have 200 mile per hour winds, even stronger than that for the higher rated ones.
And so summer is not even half over yet.
No,
and you just wonder if just an anomaly, or is it something? What's causing all the tornadoes?
Yeah, it's hard to know. You know, I mean, it's been a wet spring. It's been a stormy spring in this part of the country, and this is a part of the country that gets tornadoes, and they're associated with storms. So if you have more storms, you're probably likely to have more tornadoes, and that's a simple way to think of it. It's probably not a very deep way to think of it yet.
But a very smart way to think of it.
Yeah, smart way to
think of it. Thank you. And Kevin, thank you. Appreciate the call. And Don and Holman, you are up next. Hi, Don.
Well, thank you. I finally get to talk to the weather guys on a frustration that I've had And it's how you describe wind direction.
Mm-hmm.
A northeast wind, I understand, is coming from the northeast.
Yes.
But when it's reported to swing to the southeast, to me, it seems like it's going to be going to the southeast, because that's the terms you use. And an easterly wind, mm-hmm. which direction is that?
That's from the east.
From the east.
From the east.
Now, if an airplane was flying to the east, mm-hmm. it would be flying easterly.
Yeah, and the oceanographers talk about currents in exactly the opposite way than meteorologists. If they say there's an easterly current, they mean it's headed towards the east. So there's some conventions in these disciplines that are completely opposite of one another. It sounds like that's true with pilots too, I guess. I didn't know that.
But yeah, in meteorology, in weather, whenever we report the wind direction, it's the direction from which the wind is coming.
Right.
So a northeast swinging to the southeast.
Right.
Means that it's coming from the northeast, and then it's expected to come from the southeast.
That's
correct. Right.
So it's snow changing to rain in the wintertime.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question to have cleared up. Chris in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'm just wondering if there's a reason they aren't standardizing colors for the various warnings on TV. And to give you an example, in the Green Bay media market, you're watching one channel during bad weather, and white will be a tornado warning. You switch channels, and maybe light blue or yellow is a tornado warning, and white is a thunderstorm watch. So you might switch channels, and suddenly you're kind of panic-stricken because, you know, for me, Winnebago County is now in a white on that channel, and it was tornado warning on the previous channel for white.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I think the conveyance of that information is always subject to the local television station's legend on the screen. So that's not a Weather Service product. They'll produce the warning. They'll say this county's under a warning, but then it's up to the local station to decide how to convey that to people. But that is interesting. I never thought of that.
I never did either. It always gets me annoyed that a lot of times they'll put red and green next to each other as warnings and versus watches, which is bad because many people are colorblind.
Right.
But I never thought of that. The fact that you can change just by changing station.
And maybe they do it on purpose. Now, let's get a little bit cynical here. Maybe they do that on purpose because that's proprietary, and they want you to stick to their channel. They don't want you bouncing around, so they're going to try and scout out the other channels and see if that confuses you. Maybe opt for the maximum confusion so that you'll stay home.
All right.
It could be. I don't know.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Chris. And on to Gay in Madison. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. I have two questions. I'll ask you the big one first and then the more specific one. Are you willing to say whether or not you think that Al Gore in his Inconvenient Truth may have been largely correct? And I'll ask you the other question, which is more specific to me. We own a little piece of land in Viroqua, which is in Vernon County. And for 2 years in a row, we've had terrible flooding, and now it finally got actually into the cabin, which it had never done before, and it's getting very expensive to fix it. Can you tell me whether there's any long-range, you know, forecaster that can tell us, is this likely to continue once it starts out there?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I think Gore was largely correct.
Yes,
I
would agree.
Problem.
I would agree with that.
And what would you say about the flooding?
I would say the flooding is just an issue that's going to be so local weather dependent. I wonder about how the Chain of Lakes areas, places in the part of the state that get a lot of that the response to heavy precipitation can be remote and still disastrous. I think that I wouldn't be able to make a statement about whether or not there's going to be an increase or a decrease in these flooding events. I think that would be an imprudent thing to say.
Yeah. It's a tough thing to forecast, I think, or even to figure out,
We've certainly had our share of 100-year storms in the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
It's all occurring against the background of a changing climate. And so this goes to the first question. The former vice president sort of brought together a lot of information that was out there. He didn't write much of it himself, of course, and he doesn't say that he did. But his presentation of the consensus and the standing view of the science on climate change is exactly right. I'd say it's just about right on. It was a very fair view. And all of these flooding things are happening with that as the background. We don't know yet whether or not these flooding things are a direct consequence of that or not, but we do know they're happening at the same time that this background condition's being changed. And so, you know, maybe we can't say what's going to happen in the next 50 years.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. And guys, thank you so much. Boy, it flew by.
Yeah, it did. Good weather day for it, though.
Yeah, I know.
But you'll be back whatever the last Monday of July, whatever date that is, you'll be here.
Yeah, we'll be here.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
28th, I guess.
Oh, the 28th. Okay. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Our guests are weather guys, and they'll be back on July 28th, the last Monday of July, and we'll do this all over again. Just to take a look at what's coming up tomorrow, we'll be visiting with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant, and he has obviously many answers to your computer questions. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.